Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to call the Property Tax Relief and Local Sales Tax Division to order. And we have Representative Woffler has a few bills, so we will take House File 536. And we do not have a quorum yet, so we'll move that at another time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move this for possible inclusion in the tax bill. That's House File 536. And as you may recall, yesterday we spent some time talking about, from the citizens' bill, the idea of this old house and how that was used as a way to help people finance improvements to older houses and not have to pay for the increased value until some of the financing was but paid for that was more under control. Well, we have this new commercial industrial property here in front of you. It's the same sort of concept in that this would be using our property tax code to give a valuation reduction to business properties, commercial industrial properties that meet and exceed significantly our state energy code. We're doing a lot this session on energy conservation, renewable energy, global warming. Warming, of course, is an area of great discussion, and what I keep hearing from in my city is that beautiful big buildings for various business purposes are being designed, and as soon as the cost of construction keep going up, which unfortunately they're just skyrocketing lately in many instances, the things that get cut off as we start to get to implementing and actually filling the hole in the ground is the energy conservation measures. And so this would provide a 10-year phase tax advantage for the properties while they're recovering the cost of those additional investments. And you should have in your packet the summary of this that came from Fresh Energy. It highlights how where other states are doing this, New York, Oregon, Maryland. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to a couple of testifiers. We have Doug Pierce, who is an architect, and Bob Ambrose from Great River.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pierce, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Bob Ambrose, and if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll go first and then turn it over.
Certainly to Mr. May. Please proceed.
Thank you. I am Bob Ambrose. I'm in charge of governmental affairs for Great River Energy. Great River Energy is a wholesale electric service provider to 28 rural electric co-ops throughout Minnesota. We cover about 60% of the land area of Minnesota. The co-ops in our area are growing 3 to 5% a year in total, and that translates to about 15,000 new homes per year. We want to provide a good example to our member co-ops and their consumer members on how to provide electricity in the most energy efficient manner that we can. So when we decided to build a new headquarters in Maple Grove, we also decided to make it a showplace for energy efficiency, energy conservation, and the use of renewable energy. As a result, we expect our new headquarters, when it opens in 2008, to be one of only 16 new buildings in the world to have earned what's called the LEED Platinum certification from the U.S. Green Building Council. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Our building will be about 60% more energy efficient than is required by the state building code. Of course, it costs more to make the building that green. In our case, it costs about $1 million more. Most building owners are not going to make that decision to spend the extra money up front to do what we think is the right thing. But we hope that this building itself and our programs in it can be used to encourage other building owners to move along this path. But, of course, a tax incentive would help make that argument. Both for us and for others that we'd like to encourage to move in this green direction. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pierce, who can tell you how this works.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Mr. Pierce?
Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Douglas Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing the 2,100 members of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota, and we're a chapter of AIA National, which has over 78,000 members across the U.S. And I'm also proud to say that we're celebrating our 150th anniversary this year. Buildings, both commercial and residential, are responsible for approximately 48% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. 18% of that comes from manufacturing the materials to construct them, ship the materials, construct the buildings, and then to maintain them. Another 30% of that comes from the daily operation of buildings, heating, cooling, and lighting. And buildings consume approximately 76% of the electricity that's produced throughout the U.S. AIA in Minnesota, AIA National, fully support significant reductions in carbon emissions attributable to building operations, and we also support increased energy independence for our country. Energy-efficient buildings are an important part of that overall solution given the amount of energy that they consume. The tax incentives in this bill are based on the percent of energy use reduction below the Minnesota Energy Code. So to illustrate that, I have a couple of examples of buildings that are under construction currently. Right now, the Wilder Center, new headquarters for Wilder, is under construction. That building is projected to operate about 45% better than the code. Over 40 years, it will save about 32,000 tons of CO2 and save, in today's costs, about $2.8 million in operating costs. Great River Energy's headquarters, as Bob had noted, is we're projecting it to operate about 60% better than code, save about 39,000 tons of CO2, and save about $3.6 million over the life of the building. So to get to those kinds of efficiencies, we really do a really wide range of things. We put in high-efficiency mechanical systems, thermally improved windows. We use daylight harvesting systems that automatically dim the lights when the sun is shining. We use computerized controls in the buildings and a whole series of other things. The measures that we do to get buildings energy efficient increase the first cost of the building, and they need to be in the building's budget. Now, I've personally been involved in energy modeling almost a million square feet of space, and my firm has participated in the design of over 4 million square feet of building in the Twin Cities. And what we found is that there's really sort of two modes of operation that building owners are in. They're either totally first cost driven, and in that case, energy efficiency really is not part of their dialogue. CEOs and CFOs and the folks that run companies really don't have energy efficiency of their building on their mind. They're thinking about the cost of health insurance, trying to retain employees, all the other factors that go into business. And the people that are making early decisions, such as accountants and lenders and real estate brokers and developers, energy efficiency is not on their mind. So if we can get an incentive, tax incentive, that actually helps bring this to the surface and gets their attention. It's a very important device just to get some money in the budget early for the design of the buildings. And also, for those people that are thinking about energy efficiency on their buildings, if we can just reduce the payback a year or a year and a half, it makes it's a very big incentive for them to upgrade and make their buildings more energy efficient. So as architects, we believe in the power of creativity and the innovation to solve problems, particularly those involving our natural resources and pollution. This bill will help our profession and our industry generate solutions by reducing the demand for electricity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting idea here. Are there any questions for either one of the testifiers? I first of all want to apologize for not getting to you yesterday and appreciate you coming back today. So appreciate your patience. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every time we monkey around with the valuation of a class of property here, we're creating a special class, I guess, in this case, we're causing an imbalance in the property tax system overall. Wouldn't there be an easier way for you to get credit for this through credit against corporate profits or something like that, rather than skew the whole thing. Every time we, this is the same as that balloon. You squeeze it here, somebody else is going to get nailed over here.
Representative Wofler, one of the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I know what you're saying, but at the same time, when people are making property investment decisions, they're really focused on the property-related costs, and this is one way to bring that discussion into the equation. The accountants who manage and the people who are managing the physical plants of these large corporations are not necessarily the same people who are doing their corporate income tax forms, and I think this is one, and I think it balances, just like before you came in, Representative Earhart, I had said, you know, yesterday we had heard about the citizen idea of the this old house. Well, this is sort of the equivalent, only it's the this new building. And it's to enable the cost of those additional computer enhancements, all the extra, you know, fancy lighting systems and special heating systems to be recovered in the first 10 years of that property's life, and so that the investment gets made. And I'm not an expert on corporate tax law, but we felt this would be the most efficient way to actually relate it to the property improvements.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wofford, the problem is that this is going to shift property taxes to your homeowners, which you're always so worried about. And I think they're the last ones that we need to have extra property taxes shifted onto. That's what happens in this system. When you do monkey around with one part of it, somebody else is going to pay the piper.
Representative
or the state or whatever.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I actually think this is a good investment for our property taxpayers because we want value. As these buildings are going up, we want long-term quality value properties that are going to hold their value over a long time. Some of these buildings, as you know, are being built on spec for investors who just assume that if you build an office tower, people will rent it, and or they'll plan on holding it for 4 or 5 years and then selling it. Their interest is more of a short-term turnaround. For my community, I'd rather have buildings that are actually built to last and that will hold their value and attract businesses by reducing their operating costs. And so I think that, yes, there is some tax shifting in that first 10 years. I don't think that we're going to have so much huge construction going on that it's going to be a major impact on our homes. And I think it's the right incentive. Our communities, and I think most communities, are committed to reducing the environmental impact. In the city of Minneapolis, with the smog alerts that have become routine in the summer and now we're starting to come into the winter, we're really concerned about air quality and the energy impact of the businesses located. My area has a lot of factories, and I can tell you when one of them has their thermal oxidizer go down, I can tell you. I know it, and I can smell it in the air. And so, in particular in the area that I represent, there's a real understanding of the interplay of whether or not buildings really do invest and the right kind of equipment, and the impact they have on the surrounding homes.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor this, but you can't have it both ways. Either you're going to keep the property taxes on your homeowners down, or you're going to put it some other way. But I do have a question for counsel, Mr. Chairman. I did request that, and I think they said they could find it. You don't have it. Right, the shift in property tax burden is, and I think it's over $100 million, but I'm not sure, in property tax values. That's been shifted by Mr. O'Hara.
Sure, we can.
We'll just to illustrate the point, here's one prop, and it seems very nice, and maybe it let people construct the additional pieces of their house and not the property tax up for them. But nevertheless, somebody is paying the price on it. And that's why I think we phase it out. The same thing applies here.
Before we go further, we do have a quorum, so I do want to... Representative Wofford moves House File 536 for possible inclusion. And I have a question. I don't see anywhere in the bill, Representative Wofford, where it says new construction. And then... it looks like it could be existing.
Mr. Chair and members, it was the intention that this be for new construction too. So if we need to make a change to the language, that was the intent.
Okay. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, do you know, we have other incentives, should we say, there are things like JobZ and things like that. How would this interact with any other kind of incentives that we might have that would encourage either new business construction and or new energy efficient business construction? Is there any interaction, interplay with those things, or is that something that's maybe there's no need to take into consideration?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Loeffler. Chairman and Representative Demmer, I mean, as you know, the metro area, 7 county metro area is now eligible for that. But my sense is that for any business, any incentive that they get is the front end, probably helps expand the budget to do the right thing, whether that's, you know, this is a priority. I don't think there's anything in JobZ that targets the particular type of construction that they would do. I think where this would, it would actually be targeted only to the energy improvement enhancements that accompany that particular property.
Any other members? Anyone in the audience who would care to testify for or against 536? Yes, Mr.
Chair, I'd like to add a comment. On the value of the buildings, if these are new commercial buildings, energy efficiency requires that the building, or more than likely, the building will be more expensive to start off with, so it will start with a higher valuation just based on the energy efficiency. I don't know that that's enough to offset the incentive, but there will be a higher value to the building to start with, which would actually increase the property taxes at some level. Plus, at the end of the 10 years, energy-efficient buildings, they do have a higher value at the end. So there will be more property taxes generated in the long run.
Thank you. Testifier would come forward, please. Could you come forward, ma'am, and so we can... Yeah, did you want to testify on this bill?
Well, I just don't care to have commercial property have a tax relief for that property.
We're going to need to get you on.
And I'm having a hard time dealing with the taxes we already have.
Okay.
It would terrify me to think that we're going to get added property tax already. We're barely handling the taxes we already have.
Ma'am, would you like to officially say we need to get you on tape to officially get those comments? Just right up forward, right to the chair there, and then just state your name and then your comments, please.
All right. My name is Lois Hall. I live in New Brighton, Minnesota, and I'm a taxpayer, and the thing that worries me the most is these type of taxes keep getting shoved on homeowners, and we're at the limit. You know, you're going to be taxing seniors right out of this state. We can't keep, every year our taxes have gone up. They don't ever stay the same even. And years ago, they used to tax homes. If you lived in your home, your tax stayed the same until you sold your home. And when you sold your home, then the new people, it would be reevaluated and the new owners would have the updated taxes. They don't do that anymore. Every year our taxes have gone up and up and up. And we just have a limited income. And when we have to pay more in state taxes, it's taking away from something else that we can either neither do or something we have to eliminate. I don't have cable television. I don't have a lot of things because we have to watch how we spend our money. And it terrifies me when I see that some other form of taxation is going to get a break and put on us. This is hard for me to handle.
Well, thank you very much, and your comments are shared by many. Thank you. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, Committee, my name is Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor, and I'm on the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee.
Okay, please.
I'm testifying here today as a member of MAAO. Our organization would generally oppose this legislation in its current form, I don't think we imposed the intent, but we have a longstanding platform that we're in an ad valorem tax system in Minnesota that market value is something that should be left as transparent as possible and to reflect the value in the marketplace. And so if we're going to provide a relief or some preferential tax treatment for properties that have been built with a energy-efficient construction, that would be more appropriately provided through a separate class rate or something like that. Or alternatively, perhaps as income tax credit, maybe you could do something with sales taxes as they're building these properties. Additionally, I would say that some of the terminology in the bill gives us some pause in terms of how do we determine which properties will qualify. It's uncertain what a qualified inspector is and what the certification process would be. So if someone brings to us a building that they want to qualify for this provision, if it was enacted, how do we determine if, in fact, the building really meets those requirements?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to speak for or against? Ms. Baker has some numbers for Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, the Department of Revenue puts out a report called This Old House and summarizes in quite detail what kind of value has been excluded from it. And, of course, the program ended January 2nd, 2003. So it hasn't been in effect for several years now. But in the first year, in 94, the market value excluded was $49.1 million. And the market value in the last year, in 2002, that was excluded was $597.3 million. That is what the market value exclusion grew to over that 8-year period.
That's $500 million, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
There's a lot of detail here as far as cities and towns and, you know, how much is in all the locations. And I sure can, you know, we can get whatever information you'd like off this report. But
unfortunately, there's information for everyone.
No, I don't.
Representative Demmer.
Well, as long as we're waxing philosophical, Mr. Chair, I would submit that there's data for everything, and some of it can be information.
Thank you very much, Representative Loeffler. Any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Hines had drafted language to make it clear that it's new construction only, that if this is included in the division report, we can take advantage of. I think because we got a late start, I think we can just move this for possible consideration. I think the committee understands the intent. And I tend to think of this, to the last point, more like the incentives that Representative Demmer mentioned, where we do incent development and investment in the commercial industrial area through TIF districts, through JobZ, through other things. This is to make sure that those buildings that result are quality improvements. And I don't think that we're going to anticipate a gigantic building boom of these type of properties. But when they are built, I think we ought to make sure they last.
Thank you very much. The chair will lay over for possible inclusion of House File 536. Representative Loeffler, House File 2230.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill deals with the issue of unanticipated consequences, a common challenge in tax policy. I've been working with Representative Phyllis Kahn in trying to address issues that are confronting our communities as well as, I think, many of the college-associated communities throughout the state. We represent Northeast and Southeast Minneapolis, which has about 20 neighborhoods that are incredibly impacted by the University of Minnesota, Augsburg College, and our higher education institutions. But it is also typical, in fact, I think it was led in St. Paul with the private college is showing the way, and I'm told it's happening in other college towns. About a third of the housing in my area is duplexes, triplexes, and we have always had a mixed community. I'm an owner-occupant of a triplex, and we've always had a nice mix of single-family and rental housing, primarily in the rental housing community. It has served those university students for, you know, hundreds of years. Most of our plexes are over 100 years old. This bill deals with two different components of our tax policy that are having those unanticipated consequences in our area. First is the relative homestead, and the second is the tax advantage of single-family homes that are rented. Right, the bill would propose that we would close new applications for single-family, relative homesteads. It doesn't change the availability of agricultural relative homesteads. From what I've heard from some people, and I wasn't here when the history was put together, that it was really those when we needed to be cost effective, when people had to buy additional and bigger farms to be to run a farming business, they would often want their partner, son or daughter's family located into that next farm down the road that they purchased home and wanted that to be covered by homestead taxes, even though it might be still in the name of the principal owner, might be the father or grandfather. And but we have a situation that's arisen in particularly most dramatically in the last 5 years in which now we have parents buying houses, single-family homes, and turning them into basically rooming houses. And it's become so popular that the Minnesota Daily and this issue of their housing guide actually has a two-page article on mom and dad as landlords. It's become that big of an issue. Some city blocks, and we've actually had the city of Minneapolis, you know, map it out, have as many as 5 or 6 relative homesteads on a block. And it's more typical, though, to have about 2. But what it's doing is it's changing the dynamics of our neighborhoods because while we used to have a nice mix of homeowners and people who were really invested in the community with a few rental properties on each block, now we're seeing whole swaths starting to change into rental areas, and it's creating for some communities a real disadvantage. We financed a study last year on the U of M's impact on neighborhoods, and this was just released to the governor and the legislature earlier, and this identifies it as one of the key issues that's happening. I do have Katie Fournier, who could not be here today, sent me a letter and wanted me to note, and I'll just read a little part of it. It says, how it is our observation here in southeast Minneapolis that most of these homes are treated like rental properties. The student family member rents the other bedrooms in the home to other tenants. As students, we believe that owners of any home used in this way should pay non-homestead taxes just as any other landlord would have to do. The homes often become rental properties once the family member has finished at the university, either by the family owners continuing to rent it to university students as landlords or through resale to commercial owner. Although some families are responsible owners of these homes, many are not in a position to monitor the behavior of their occupant family members, nor do they do the maintenance on these homes that owner-occupants would do. The result is a situation similar to that of a negligent absentee landlord. And we're sure that many of these situations, I mean, we know of single-family homes where you have 10 or 12 people. They create new bedrooms in places that they weren't before. It's a different way of dealing with the high tuition increases that we've run into. The second item removes the tax advantage of single-family homes that are rented. Right now, they are taxed at the same class rate as single-family homestead, 1%. And the small-scale rentals, the duplex and triplexes, are at 1.25%. And since single-family homes are naturally advantaged to an investor, they have faster appreciating, they don't have to mediate between the upstairs, downstairs neighbor fights. They're preferred by tenants, and they're easier to get out of if you decide you're not going to like being a landlord. They also tend to appreciate faster. And I was originally thinking that I would raise up the single-family up to the duplex and triplex, or I could go down, and I wasn't quite sure which way to go until we had a handout that Keith Carlson provided, which showed that the biggest tax increases in the past 5 years have actually been the residential rental pieces. And I'm just looking for Keith's original handout. Here it is. This was one of the handouts that we had, and it shows that from 2001 to 2006, the increases by class The big blue line here is the non-residential, non-homestead, both single family and the plexus. The apartments are down 5%. And then the next largest was the seasonal recreation, which we've heard a lot about. And so when I looked at this, I said, well, maybe since they've already absorbed a 100% increase and they've increased three times faster than any other class property, we should actually drop it down rather than raise it up. Steve Hines did some research last night and actually was able to determine that it's actually the single family rentals went up even higher than the plexus and during that period of time. And the end result of this is in the last 5 years, the number of homesteads in our cities have really dropped. In St. Paul, the drop was 3,400 single families converted to rental, a 5.4% increase, 5.4% of their properties. Duluth had an increase of 1,000 single family homes converting, and in Minneapolis it was 3,000. So this is, you know, a documented trend. It's not just sort of a small thing, and it's a significant change in our housing makeup that I don't think was ever the intention when this was put together. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have a testifier from the University Impact Zone that would like to just make a couple of brief remarks.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you. Wendy Menton. I'm from the Southeast Como neighborhood, and thank you, Chair and Committee, for letting me have a second to speak. A lot of what was already said, I'll kind of reiterate it. I'm basically going to speak today as a case study example. I'll just speak on behalf of what I see directly, how it's impacted my own neighborhood. Although we're hearing from many other neighborhoods why this is going forward this way. We have many properties that are relative homesteaded at the moment. We have approximately 5% of our properties are relative homesteaded. And I would be very hard-pressed to name one or two of them that I know of where it was probably done with the intent of the law, where it truly was an effort to give a child access to housing. Instead, what has happened, as was mentioned, that we're finding the parents are buying for their children, but with not any intent whatsoever to create a home, you know, a homeowner-type property. In fact, in some cases, the children are actually buying it with the help of the parents, so it's in the child's name, but that's a different, you know, whole different issue. They have found that they can, in effect, turn these into a very high income-generating rental properties. And often often the number of tenants in these properties outnumber the resident owners. They are looked at as only a short-term solution to going to college. They are not looked at as a traditional homeowner would. Our experience has been that they aren't maintained. It's a virtual absentee management site. You know, the child may be there, but they're not going to fix the windows. They're not going to fix the doors. They don't really care. And the parents are off-site. This was created is because of the loophole in the law. There's actually a double layer here at the city level because even though they're rented, since they're homesteaded, they don't have to pull a rental license, and they don't have to be inspected by the city inspection process for safety and occupancy and legal egress or anything else. I will use an example. Oh, and I was just going to point out that because we have some properties that are in very difficult condition already, what we're finding is they're targeting our better properties to buy and take over from the front end. As an example of this, I have a house on 23rd that was recently built as a new house. It has 7 bedrooms, 4 baths, and rumor has it has 2 kitchens. It's listed as a single-family relative homestead when it was built. It was fully occupied and fully rented at that time. If you do the simple math, that's about $2,400 a month on income on that property. It's never been inspected, and it doesn't have to have a rental license. So the return on this is pretty great. Once a property has been converted, it is not going back to absentee owner, back to home ownership. It's going on to absentee owner, or it goes on to another relative homestead. Realtors have found that this is a very lucrative market to because you are almost guaranteed to be able to resell that house within every 2 to 3 year cycle. The house behind me has sold 2 or 3 times in like 5 years. in this example that I gave you, it, the impact on it has already meant that the houses on either side have now gone up for sale, and at least one of the houses located behind it has also gone up for sale. The question might arise, is it really that dramatic an issue? And I can say that Southeast Como is a case study of proving that it is. As mentioned, we did recently do a large-scale study of which you probably have or will get a copy of this that identifies this as one of the key items in there. And while it is not the only reason given, a number to throw on the table on the impact is that Southeast Como has lost 17% of its resident homeowners since 2000. I mean, they are literally fleeing this issue. The increase of the relative homestead abuse is one of the reasons that is usually given by people that are selling and leaving. And I was just at a school board meeting last night where it was announced out of the clear blue sky that the school in my neighborhood, Tuttle School, is slated to close. So there isn't enough homesteaders and enough families in my neighborhood anymore to keep it viable. So it has had a dramatic and very negative impact on my community. And another thing that doesn't usually get mentioned, but we were an affordable housing neighborhood. We were the neighborhood where parents and with families with young kids could often buy their first home. We were always behind the market curve. This has helped create a market dynamic where these parents and these children going to school can create a market dynamic that has drastically outpriced the housing for families and families with children. So I realize that, you know, removing this from the code won't solve this problem, but I just ask that people take it under consideration because we certainly don't need to encourage and incent this practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Loeffler? Anyone from the audience that would care to speak for or against this bill? Not members, any questions for Representative Loeffler or Representative Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask our director at the lady that just spoke, I think it was, is that the Southeast Como neighborhood?
If you could come forward again, Ms. Mankin.
Mr. Chairman and ma'am, you are asking state law to be changed so that we benefit your neighborhood.
I'm using my neighborhood as an example of what it is doing. It's hoping that it will reverse the negative trends that this law has helped create in my neighborhood. But I also talk to other neighborhoods across the city of Minneapolis. I have been in conversations with neighborhoods in Duluth who are running into this. And if you look at other states that have had a relative homesteading law on the books, they're also revisiting it. If nothing else, they're opening up and requiring rental licenses and allowing the city to pull rental licenses on these properties. So I would disagree that it's purely to benefit my neighborhood, although I hope it will benefit my neighborhood.
Well, Mr. Chairman and ma'am, I think you're talking about neighborhoods that are in proximity to colleges and universities, if I'm hearing you right, and this is student housing that otherwise might not be afforded. So you're going to cut into the student housing market, for one thing, because not every student can afford to live in one of the high-priced dorms over there.
Mm-hmm. Statistically, that actually... Oh, I'm sorry.
Right.
I was just going to say, statistically, and if you look at the data, that is not true. There is nothing between the occupancy levels and the relative homestead that correlates to affordability for student housing. The rate per pupil, rate per renter in our housing in Southeast Como, if you look, has gone up at a greater rate than the city as a whole. So back in 1997, they were able to rent a room, you know, in a more legally run property for, you know, anywhere from $2 to $250 a person. We're up to $400, $450 a person. So if you actually map that out against, say, an uptown neighborhood and the stresses they have on their occupancy and their properties, the market rate has dictated. And what's happening is they've realized that they've got a fixed market. So they're actually abusing the market to push that rate. So the reports and the data show that it's not making this affordable for students.
Well, Mr. Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, it's more affordable because it's supply and demand in an immediate area. And I'm aware that the university does not have enough housing because I'm involved with some student housing that's trying to build some new student housing over there. But besides that, you were mentioning that these properties are often in a state of disrepair. Now, the city has inspectors that if you call the inspectors or are on their case, they will come and inspect the properties and bring them up to code or cite the owners. So I don't know why you don't go that route as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
And Representative Earhart, we'll have to get you a copy of the report, but actually there has been tremendous new construction in the university area, which has actually also played into the deterioration of the plexus and the that there. We actually have, if you drive through Southeast right now, if you drive through Northeast, you will see probably every fourth or fifth block a plex that has a for rent sign in front of it. We actually have a huge vacancy problem right now because we've, as the university has reduced its student body over time to really focus on a core mission, it has at the same time built new housing near the campus, and the traditional student housing, a lot of it is sitting vacant and is not being maintained as a result, or is going, as our witness said, what's happening is that these new investors are buying up the nice single-family homes that have traditionally been well-maintained by families over time, and they're buying that up, they're renting it to seven or eight students, while the property next door that was a plex that was designed for rental sits vacant because it won't appreciate as fast as a single family. And for a family that's looking at just investing for the 4 years or 5 years that their child is there, they want to make sure that it appreciates and they come out with a profit. So they buy the nice properties, the kids move in, they may or may not take good care of it, and you end up with the traditional rental housing actually going downhill while new stuff is being converted. So there's a real dynamic market happening here, and it's all outlined in this report, and I will make sure that you get a copy of it, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, what you're talking about is the free market at work.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler, you need to move your bill. I think
yes.
You forgot to do that. House File 2230.
Mr. Chair, I would move that my bill be considered for possible inclusion in the division report. And just to summarize, I understand that the market will and investors will always make choices based on dollars and that this has some impact on their choices, but not the only impact. But I don't think it should be our tax policy to encourage the conversion of single-family homes to rental or to discourage the investment and maintenance of and the rental of the plexus, which were actually designed for rental housing. And I'm hopeful that we can work together to help these types of communities throughout the state, whether it's near the private colleges in St. Paul or it's near the University of Minneapolis.
Thank you very much. Chair will lay over House File 2230. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Brown, you have House File 2231. Representative Brown, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2231 to be possibly included in the division report.
Please proceed. Thank you.
The bill is very short, and I hope I don't talk longer than the few sentences that it includes. But what it's asking to do is to provide LGA to towns at a rate of $5 per capita. And this would be to the towns that in the previous year had levied for property taxes. There's a little bit of history behind it. We had been providing aid starting in the early 70s, and it was in about 2001 where townships stopped receiving that aid, and this is an attempt to get them some dollars that will help them provide the services that they do still provide.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Brown? Any testifiers?
I don't have any, but I'm wondering if somebody in the audience might
Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 2231? If not, thank you so much. The chair will lay over House File 2231.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 2242.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2242 for possible inclusion into the division report.
Did you have an author's amendment or anything?
I don't believe so, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Marquardt, would you like to speak to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 2242 is what Representative Earhart would call monkeying around a bit with the system. But the situation was brought to us from a restaurant owner who has his business along a lake, on a lake. And it's very seasonal. And for about 4 months out of the year, he makes up most of his revenue. And then for the other 8 months of the year, there's not much. So he got to thinking, you know, it's more kind of a seasonal type thing, like resorts and seasonal rec and that. And the current classification would be 3A, which would be regular commercial industrial, which means you have the state general tax and 1.5 on the first 150,000 and 2.0 after that. This would shift it to a 4C10, which when you look at what's all under there, it's really quite a smattering of things. But 4C1, for example, is seasonal recreational residential, and then you've got qualifying golf courses, 4C2, and then 4C3 is nonprofit community services. There's 9 of them currently right now. In fact, 4C9 is bed and breakfast up to 5 units, so it's kind of a somewhat of a catch-all. There would be, of course, certain requirements that they could not be devoted to commercial purposes not more than 250 consecutive days, or bring in more than 60% of their revenue in this restaurant, which would include bar, over a period of 4 months. So it would certainly be a business that would be seasonal. Now, you might think this is only rural Minnesota, but in fact, it could qualify for a seasonal restaurant along Lake Minnetonka, for example. So it's not just a rural situation, although it might apply there more than often. So I have no witnesses, and that's my testimony.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how many property taxpayers would fall into this category who had a seasonal restaurant property? How many would fall into this category?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, I'd have to refer to staff on that.
Madam Chair.
We discussed that a bit, but yeah. I don't know if we came up with
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, we really don't have any idea because, you know, what we're talking about here is, first of all, there's an option of either 250 days or the 60% gross receipts. And the other thing is some that may now be open more than that might decide that this is worth it and decide, you know, I mean, if they're close to that threshold. So you really don't know what, you know, who might fall into it. But, you know, the idea here is that most of their business is coming in a very short period of time, and the rest of the year or a lot of the rest of the year, they really are not getting much business. It's kind of like the small resorts. In some ways.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. So, Madam Chair, of Zamar.
Yes, Senator Paymar.
A constituent brought this to your attention? Is that how the bill came before us?
Yes, Senator Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar actually brought to Representative Junkie, and then it was referred to the property tax comment line from there, and then we met with the owner and thought maybe there's something we could work out there.
So I'm new to this committee, so I've noticed this with Representative Hamilton, too. Is it typical for members to bring bills before the tax committee that helps out one constituent and help out more? I just want to know because I want to let people in my district know that this is something that I can maybe do for them.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, you bring up a great point. And if I didn't think this applied to more than one, I wouldn't have brought it. But I do think there are a number of businesses, I mean, especially along the lakes, that would be very seasonal. And so, I mean, it certainly would involve more than one, but sometimes it takes one person to kind of bring that problem to light. But I do think this would have a statewide appeal to it, I think this would impact a number of owners. And so maybe it need to be tightened up and also. But.
Well, Madam Chair, if some are questions, I suspect that there are lots of people that could take advantage of it. We're just shifting the property tax burden around, aren't we?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, it would be Representative Earhart's monkeying with the system, yes, if that would be.
Thank you.
There would be some.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Paymar's point, I can speak from personal experience where we have a lake home. There are several restaurants that would qualify for this. And so I think there are probably more of these properties around the state than we might think. Representative Marquardt, I was wondering if there's a definition as to what it means to be on the lake. I can think of situations where they're really on the lake. I think of one restaurant that I know about that has lake frontage, but their business is actually across the road, probably 300 feet from the lake. Have you identified that question at all as to what really on the lake means?
Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, we talked briefly on that. I don't know if we ever came up with any conclusion. Certainly not what you're suggesting, a road in between where it might be within 300 feet. I don't know if there's an official definition. I don't remember that part coming up, and maybe Ms. Baker would know. But that would be something you might have to define more clearly in this bill.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest maybe that on the lake be defined that they have frontage, even though the particular restaurant itself, that it be contiguous and that it have frontage on the lake, it would seem to me. If the other solution would be within a certain number of feet, shoreline management, I think, what is it, within 350 feet or whatever, I think they have some provision. That might be another way to come at this.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I think that's an excellent suggestion. Thank you.
Representative Earhart?
Madam Chair, I would think that any lake of any size in Minnesota is going to have at least one property like this. And, of course, the problem with shifting in that area, we have a very sensitive group of cabin owners that have been experiencing rapid increases in their valuation. So even if it's only shifts a little, it's going to shift onto their cabin property.
Representative Lenchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, Representative Marquardt, I don't see that it's just a greater Minnesota bill. I don't think so. And there are restaurants on the lakes in the Twin Cities as well. Lake Minnetonka is full of them. And so I'm thinking not just shifting them on cabins. I'm thinking about shifting them on properties. And that piece that Representative Lanning was just mentioning, on the lake versus somewhere else. I mean, if you just walk around Lake Harriet, those of you who live in the metro know there's not anything technically on Lake Harriet because the city bought the abutting property, but definitely you get 30 feet out, lots of it. And lots of restaurants and bars on, you know, Lake of the Isles, Lake Nokomis, Lake Harriet, Lake Calhoun, you know. So I just think there's a lot to think about here, and I want to make sure members realize this would have a metro impact as well, not just the.
Are there any members of the audience that want to speak to this bill?
Madam Chair, how come I gain so many fans when I'm up here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Kevin Masick. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Restaurant Association. I wanted to indicate our support for this legislation. It's not part of our priorities that we brought forward, but the owner, the constituent of Representative Junkies, came forward with us, and I've spoken with him on the bill. And the issue really kind of centers around these restaurants that are on the lake, and the bulk of their business comes during the summer when the boaters are out there boating, and they dock and they use the restaurant, and they don't have a whole lot of business during the winter and the kind of the shoulder seasons. And so what's happening is, as we all know, that the property tax values on the lakes are rising, but these businesses, especially this gentleman and a couple others that I've since spoke to, as the property taxes are rising, it becomes less and less attractive for them to maintain the restaurant on the lake. And what this gentleman had done in the past, has done now, is has gone to a seasonal. He's closed down for about 4 months during the year, just in order to, because he was losing money. And I think we're going to see more and more of that with these restaurants on the lake. And this is, we appreciate the author bringing this forward, looking at this as a way to kind of preserve those lake shore restaurants, because we're going to, especially this gentleman is really debating whether or not he's going to be able to keep the business open with the property taxes that are going increasing.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Oh, Madam Chair, and to the author, I was just actually thinking that I'm more empathetic to the Main Street diner that doesn't have that great value, who's also got, you know, just a seasonal sort of business in terms of when all the lake people come, and I could see that this could start to get other seasonal businesses dreaming of, and maybe they should. I don't know.
Representative Marquardt, do you have closing remarks?
So, Madam Chair, I just think it is a statewide issue that, we see around the lakes, and it's tough for some of those seasonal businesses to operate, and I think this would help them. So, thank you.
And then I do lay over House File 2242 for possible inclusion in the division report. We finished all our business, and we're adjourned.